Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 241 for June 15th, 2022. I'm your host, Chris Webster, and on today's show, we talk about different ways to get published. So open that new expense account because your huge advance is coming and because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Bill in Northern California.
Good morning.
Heather in, I don't know, Southern California.
Good morning, or welcome everyone.
That's right. And Andrew. Andrew also in Southern California.
Hey guys, how's it going?
All right. And I am in Ocean Shores, Washington. Rainy Ocean Shores, Washington. Mm. The rest of the country, I was looking at the weather last night. It's going to have highs this week in like much of Central Valley, California, on into the Southwest and over into the Southeast of like 100 plus degrees. Yeah. Pretty sure the high every day this week and next week in Ocean Shores, Washington is 60 and raining. It's crazy. It's crazy the difference up here. I love it. Although we're totally sucked in and it rained all day yesterday.
Yeah, last week I went to go visit my brother in Portland and we went to the zoo.
Yeah.
And I learned real quick the difference between kids born in the Pacific Northwest and kids born in Tucson. Because when rain touches a kid from Tucson, like just sadness, you know, you just, I don't care about seeing that tiger. I just want to go, you know. And then the other kids are like, what's wrong? You know, they're soaked all the way. Their pants are soaked. They're totally soaked, you know. Well, yeah, let's go see the tiger. And my kids are just like, yeah, it's raining. Like, let's just go. That's it. The day's over. It's raining.
Yeah. Last week we were up in a little tiny, tiny town called Quilcene, Washington. And it's just outside like Bremerton, Paulsbo area on the Washington Peninsula as a ferry ride from Seattle. And there was a family up there next to an old family friend of ours that has like this, it's kind of a family reunion, but they just invite anybody in. So we were hanging up there for the 3 days of Memorial Day weekend, and it's outside, they're camping, and it was literally raining the entire time. And some of the kids didn't even have like shoes on. I mean, it's upper 50s, low 60s. It's raining. It's muddy. They're just running around. We're sitting by the campfire and, you know, having good food. And because one of the people that kind of runs the whole thing, the matriarch, she's actually an executive chef at a fancy restaurant. And so the food was amazing. And, you know, nobody cared that it was raining. You just wore a rain jacket and, you know, we're all sitting out there and it just didn't matter. That's Pacific Northwest for you.
Yeah, no joke. It doesn't, like, rain is not a thing. No one cares about rain in the Pacific Northwest, because if they did, they wouldn't actually be able to go outside ever.
Exactly.
That's right. That's right.
When I lived in Seattle too, I remember, you know, I took the bus, so I had a rain jacket on and an umbrella, and I'm like, I mean, everything but a force shield to keep water from touching me. And I'd get to work, you know, my pants are reasonably dry. They'd dry off in a little while. My colleagues would come with just some, you know, cotton hoodie, pants totally soaked. And then we'd go home at like 5 o'clock and their pants were still wet. And I was like, are your feet wet? And they're kind of like, yeah. And I was like, we just were in this office for 8 hours and your feet were wet the whole time and your legs were wet the whole time. They just kind of look at me like, it's Seattle, bro. Like, what are you talking about? We're wet all the time.
What's the problem?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. All right. Well, getting to today's topic, it is Andrew's shot this time. And we are somewhat revisiting a topic we've talked about a long time ago, but this is an ever-changing discussion and it's good to have it again for people that are interested. So Andrew, why don't you introduce our topic today?
Sure. I thought today we would do how to publish in archaeology for two reasons. Reason number one is we touched on this last time, and it seemed to be kind of a natural flow from our conversations from 2 weeks ago. And also, I have kept a little list to myself every so often of like ideas I have for the podcast, and it was on there as well. So I'm like, two for two, you know, let's just do how to publish. So I thought we could just take the time. And what's really cool here is the people we have right now on the podcast, we all have publishing stories in different realms of publishing. As I thought about my own experience, and maybe your guys too, we'll see what you guys say. When you're writing a book or an article or anything like that, it's funny. It's a really solo journey. It can be a really lonely journey when you're doing it, because kind of the nature of the beast, you're doing it by yourself, you know, and also just that whole, the whole world of like how to do this. And if you meet with publishers, you're like, am I doing this right? Am I totally getting shafted? Mm-hmm. Are they taking advantage of me? You know, and I thought that we could just help our audience, you know, and be like, hey guys, this is our experiences in the real world. Your mileage may vary, but we're going to try our best to help you out.
Yeah, indeed. That's a good topic.
Yeah, sure. So what do you, I mean, there's kind of like three different ways to publish. And my favorite way is just to like write on your own blog. Then you just have to deal with the people who've read it, and they try to give you comments/edits on what's happening, but you just get to write. And you know, that's my favorite way, because it just flows out and you publish it and then you just sit back and it's done.
You know, a question about that, Bill, because you've been writing on your blog for quite some time now. You've had some posts that, in fact, quite a few posts that have really hit and resonated with people and been shared and commented on when it's shared on like social media. I'm wondering, you know, a lot of times one of the reasons people write, which is probably the first thing you got to look at, is, you know, why are you writing what you want to write? Is it because you're passionate about the topic, or is it because, to be honest, to be totally honest, you're trying to gain a little bit of credibility in a topic or a field or something like that? How has your blog helped or hurt you in, I guess, job searches and, you know, things like that? I mean, right as soon as you got out of your PhD, I mean, you pretty much went straight into Berkeley. I don't know if your blog or this podcast or those other outlets helped you, or was something you had to explain away.
Yeah. Well, explain away, right? Well, it is definitely one of the reasons behind the radio silence the last few years of trying to get tenure. I realized, like, man, I got 200 and some posts on here, and some of this stuff doesn't really sound very good for other professors. If they read it, they're probably going to get pretty pissed off at what I've said on the internet. Stuff like, you know, if you're a field tech and you've worked 40 hours a week for like 3 or 4 years, you probably know more than every assistant professor at your university when you go get your master's, because you actually know how to do archaeology. Like, you were out there outside doing it for real, standing next to a backhoe, you know, eating a taquito from a gas station to survive. That's not someone who went to Columbia and got an NSF grant. They don't know about that life. So that kind of stuff, you know, I have been keeping my mouth shut on that stuff the last few years. So I guess, you know, I've been, you know, quiet, essentially. I got blog posts and I don't post them. I actually was writing one this last weekend and I was like, yeah, I don't think I should post this till I get tenure, right? But so that's one way, right? Because I'm super concerned that I will say something on my blog that someone will get frustrated. But I don't take blog posts down either. So the ones that people don't like, you know, I will add a note or comment it in the post later on, but I leave them published, you know, so they just sit there. So anyone can see that stuff as long as I pay for my hosting.
Right.
So I don't know if it, I guess maybe it's kind of hindered me, right? Because I keep quiet and I don't say a lot of stuff on my blog anymore and just really focus on the podcast. I will say though that, in, you know, the other stuff that I had to do took up a lot of the time that I was writing blog posts, because 3,000 and 4,000 word blog posts take a long time to write, but those words also had to be applied towards other stuff like grant applications and articles and book chapters and, you know, the book that I wrote for tenure. So when it comes to the amount of hours a day, I just haven't had as many hours to write on my blog.
Right.
Because I had to devote those to other kinds of things.
I could totally see that. Although I think you bring up two cool things, Bill. First, I think the blog post is a great idea for authors out there wanting to start, because it shows you're serious, you know, like you will actually write, because anyone can have an idea. Anyone can be like, oh, I got this great idea for this book. And I'm like, OK, show me your chapters. You know, it's a very different thing to actually do the stuff. So, yeah, a blog is kind of proof of concept where it's like, yeah, I will actually write. And I also think you do another thing that's important is that you're bold and you're yourself in your blog post. And I would say anyone out there who's thinking of writing, you have to be bold. You have to be yourself. You can't like half ass it. You know, you have to just you just have to hang it out there and be honest, because it'll make your writing that much better.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that now because I'm going up for tenure. That's actually part of my tenure package, though, the podcast and the blogging and the other informal publications. They're putting that in there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how we're counting it because it's like a new thing. The thing is only designed for like, how much committee work have you done? How many books have you written? How many classes did you teach? There's no like, you know, how many podcasts and engagement have you had? How many public talks did you give on, you know, Zoom? How many other things have you done? It's only like money, pages written, classes taught, you know, like how much have you done of those things? So we're trying to figure out some kind of way because, you know, it's still a form of publication and it's out there and it's actually getting way more attention than any of the articles I write. So, I don't know. I don't know how that'll count. We're writing it in there. It's going in there now. But, you know, I was also doing all the other traditional stuff, too, as far as writing.
Well, see, you're doing all the stuff. And you know, speaking of that, I was trying to figure out, like, okay, what kind of outlets of publications are there? So we have, like, the blog. There's gray literature where you just kind of write a CRM report. You know, there's peer-reviewed journal where it's, you know, much more sort of academic kind of hoity-toity. You have the edited volume, which is like a peer-reviewed journal, but you kind of write a paper for a publication. You kind of do one chapter of a book. Self-publishing, which I want to get to that, Bill, I know that you've done. And then I would say you have a classic publisher of a small publishing company and then classic publisher of a large publishing company. And those were the ones I could kind of tease out if I was thinking of, you know, the options for publishing something.
Yeah. I mean, you're writing for yourself or doing informal stuff, blogging, podcasting and stuff like that. Then there's also all the other, like you said, the gray literature. And then there's the other stuff that's, you know, reviewed by other PhDs. Right. So I think that I wouldn't have been able to blog if I hadn't written CRM reports, because you got to write on command. Seriously, the hours are ticking. And if you don't write it and it's not grammatically correct and logical and stuff like that, I don't really know how you're going to stay in CRM. Like that's one of the big differences. And if you never really learn how to write, you know, in cultural resources, and I'd say that you get a huge assist in cultural resources because you always have boilerplate, right? And because like plagiarism is a different kind of thing in CRM. It's bad to plagiarize another company, but your own thing is just like, you know, keep mixing the pot. And so that really does help because you've got chunks already written and you just have to edit it. And there's also logic behind how those paragraphs and that other stuff is put together. When you get taught how to write, which one of the things that I really got helped out, my company that I first worked for in Seattle, a lot of us master's students, we weren't really good at writing and we were causing a lot of delays and a lot of problems because the higher ups had to keep editing what we were writing because no one ever taught us how to write. And so there was a technical writing company that the people, the principal investigators hired this group to teach us how to write. And those techniques, man, I'm telling you, the stuff that I learned back in like 2004, 2005, I still rehash it in like every blog post, every sentence, every essay that a student writes. That's how I edit their stuff because that's the foundational technical writing that exists in the English speaking world. And it's logical. And if you figure out how to build sentences and paragraphs properly, you can write anything you want in archaeology. And so, you know, if I hadn't gotten that and I hadn't had to write letter reports and little survey reports and all that stuff, then I wouldn't be able to write a coherent blog post.
Yeah.
And I can see that in other people's blogs. I can see that in the cut and paste news world that we live, that people just, they're not writing proper paragraphs and the stuff stinks, you know?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's shocking to me when we have somebody come in. That's one of the hardest skills to find are people that can write and write well, where most of the time I'm having to rewrite things. And it can be it's difficult because it takes so much extra time. And then you think to yourself, okay, I should just write this to, you know, to start with. If I'm going to rewrite it myself in the CRM business, I think for people who manage, part of your job is training people. And, you know, I've created templates to teach people to fill in the blank first, to learn through filling in the blank. And hopefully then they're learning how to structure the report and how to structure certain paragraphs and how to treat, you know, certain sections of a report. Because when I first started, I had a very kind of a mixture of data presentation and an editorial style, which for technical writing is not as efficient. Reports shouldn't be editorial. Yeah. For the most part. And so it's a very different style of writing. And I really enjoyed the style of writing I used when I was in school. And I realized that, that doesn't work for CRM reports necessarily, not totally. And so it had to shift how I wrote in general. And now I'm a very different writer than I was, you know, 15 years ago. People are not taught, I mean, they don't even use tenses correctly. They don't know how to, you know, have a tense and stay with the same tense across the board. And actually, it is a little more difficult, I think, in specifically in our business, because you are talking about the past quite a bit. And so trying to shift from presenting information in the present when you're talking about things in the past, I know can be complicated, but it really, people do have to think about that. And I don't think anybody even, I don't see people realizing that that is something that they should be thinking about when they're writing, you know, sections for a report. And so I think, you know, I know we're kind of getting off on the writing aspect here, but I think that, you know, CRM writing is such an important skill, and they're not being taught that in school. I don't think personally, because most people that come out that we really are teaching people from scratch in how to technically write.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I actually am. I'm doing what my eighth grade teacher taught me, you know, simple. I put a video in here. That's a video that's like required for all my students. If you do this, I guarantee you, you're going to get an A in my class, because it's really difficult to, if you write proper paragraphs and proper essays, then you have fulfilled the obligations of the assignment. And it's very difficult to get anything less than an A, unless you like totally miss the point on what you're doing. But even still, it'll be coherent in quality. And when I see people write like this, it's what I was taught when I was like in eighth grade English. They don't teach diagramming sentences. This is the background of that technical writing course that we had to take, you know, almost 20 years ago. This is what is. And so like watching this video, I show all my students, and I know the students who practice this well get grants, they get scholarships, they get in to graduate programs, they get all kinds of stuff because they know how to logically write. I mean, you can dispute your bill with Verizon if you properly know how to write a paragraph.
Yes. And, you know, I think I mean, in the defense of university professors, it can be pretty overwhelming, because students coming in from high school, they're not being taught this. We're just, unfortunately, in our public school system, we're not teaching people how to write.
Yeah, but sorry. I just wanted to say also, once again, the professors don't know how to write. Like, read what they write. It is not quality. And you can look at the paragraphs and figure out that it doesn't make any sense. You look at these long one-page paragraphs that are just, you know, pasted together with semicolons, all kinds of crazy adjective use, very unclear sentences and stuff, and it gets published. Because the publisher, well, we'll talk about this in the next segment, but those who are publishing these articles are not there to police our grammar. It's there to just get content for people to look at it.
True. And you do see that in news articles. Yeah. That is actually pretty shocking in the last few years. Yeah.
Okay. So let's go ahead and take a break. And on the other side, we'll get into a little bit more publishing, maybe some book publishing stuff. So we'll do that in a minute. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 241. And we are joined by Doug. Doug, how's it going?
Hey, everyone.
All right. So we're going to continue talking about publishing. And to kick off segment two, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Author Professor Andrew Kinkella.
Go ahead. I am so important, but I do have a couple other titles which you didn't get in there, and I'm very angry.
It's segment two.
Just get it straight.
I got a few for you, Andrew, but I don't think it's appropriate on a podcast.
So, I'm sure there are a few more.
Look, I am a professional, so I'm going to bring it back and get through this. So, last bit there, we were talking about publishing kind of in the CRM world and technical writing and that kind of thing, which is a skill that is so good to have if you have it. I know I'm classically, it's one of my difficulties, but on the flip side, on the complete other side of the coin, if you're trying to publish something and you want to go to a publisher, you're like, oh, I have an idea for a book. There's a couple different ways to go about that. And I know I personally had a ton of questions about this. But for myself, I asked colleagues and other people, and I have to say that their answers didn't help me that much. And I think it goes back to what we touched on last time, which is it's such a solo effort and there's so much variety. But what I would say shortly is if you meet with a publisher, in my experience, they'll always say that your idea is great, no matter what, because they want right of first refusal. What if you come up with an awesome book? You know, so almost no matter what you say, you know, they'll be like, oh, yeah, that sounds. Oh, send it to me. So if you do have an idea for a book, I would definitely write it down though. And I'm telling you, the proof is in the steel in the walls, meaning, yes, you can have an idea, but write it out. And as you're writing your idea, I would do a few things. First, most publishers' websites have a little tab that'll say, like, for the author.
Yeah.
Go there, and they'll have the directions on what they want for submissions. And most of them are very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they'll say that they want, like, a title. They want, like, expanded table of contents where you kind of explain what each chapter is. And then they'll want you to write one chapter. It's usually chapter one, but it's whatever you have the most kind of impetus to write. So that to me is a major, major step. If people are interested in publishing, it's actually writing out that prospectus, you know, and you'll also have to answer questions like, what books does this compete with? And you have to think like a business person at that moment. You can't just be like, well, my awesome idea competes with nothing just because it's me. No, the world doesn't care. You have to think as a publisher, you know, you have to be like, oh yeah, who's going to actually buy this? And how much is it going to cost? And is it going to be color photos or black and white? You know, there's a lot there, but I would not be fearful of meeting with a publisher or anything like that. Just I would do it. I would be professional about it. Meet with different publishers. It's so funny, like ones that you think would never want it might totally want it and vice versa. So variety is the spice of life when meeting with publishers.
I think, too, in my experience anyway, and my experience is extremely limited and very fortunate, to be honest, but in my experience, and there's some other things to look at as well, especially the type of publisher that you're looking at, right?
Oh,
so if they've already got a book that or a series of books or a number of books that are exactly like the one that you want to write, not that it would be the same book, but it's like in the same vein. They don't necessarily want to compete with themselves. You know what I mean?
Right.
So if they've already got something that's doing really well, like I wouldn't approach Tom King's publisher and say, I want to write a book called Cultural Laws in Practice. They're probably not going to do it, right? He's on like the seventh edition or something. So,
absolutely.
You know, that's just too much competition. But these smaller publishers too, you got to figure you're not talking to Random House here, right? You're not trying to write the next Harry Potter. If you are, and you're Brian Fagan, then you better have a pedigree like he does and the books that he already does in order to get a publisher like that, because they're likely going to give you some kind of an advance or something to actually write this book. But you have to have the cred to do that. But more than likely, you're going to approach somebody who's a little smaller, like I did randomly, not even looking to publish a book. I saw the Left Coast Press table and I'd heard about Left Coast Press. Tom King had published there quite extensively and other people had published there. And it just Left Coast Press was like a publisher for archaeology books, right? And it's like a small publisher for archaeology books. They're based in California. They seemed like a good fit. And I had quite a few blog posts and I had a whole series of blog posts that I'd actually put together. I'd pulled from my blog. I'd fleshed out the posts a little bit and I put them all into a PDF. And it was, I don't know, it was already basically something that was done. And I was thinking about just making an ebook or some sort of collection out of it so people could get this collection of information that I'd already written. And I just showed it to the person at the Left Coast Press table at a conference. And I was like, does this, I wasn't even asking them to publish it. I was just like, hey, do you guys know, because you'd be the ones to know this, if anything like this exists. And she took a look at it and she was like, basically, she said, no, send us a proposal. And I was like, oh, well, I wasn't even thinking about that. I was just kind of asking if this was on the market. So I sent her a proposal. And because I basically had the thing already written, they took it. So I've submitted, well, I've actually submitted two book proposals and one of them got selected. So, and they're for two different books. I actually tried submitting to the Idiot's Guide, I think it was, or something like that, to do like a CRM archaeology for dummies or idiots or whichever one that was.
Great
idea. And they said, no, they said it's too much of a niche topic. And I'm like, you have the Idiot's Guide to Opera. Like, are you kidding me right now? So anyway, they didn't do it. But yeah, but that was my experience with Left Coast is the point I wanted to make with that is if you go to conferences and you have an idea for a book, like Andrew said, have a table of contents. So you know what the book is going to be structured like, have a chapter written, or at least most of a chapter written, so they can at least see your writing style. And not that they will necessarily look at it at the conference, but they'll know you're serious if you show up with that. And sometimes those people working the tables are the editors. They're not just, if it's a smaller company, they don't have like lackeys that go to conferences. It's them that go to the conferences, right? So talk to them and talk to them as though they're the editor. You may not know they're the editor, but pretend that they are just in case. You don't want to piss them off.
Yeah. You know, that was the first editor I ever talked to was Left Coast Press. The editor himself was at the conference, you know, and so I ultimately didn't work with Left Coast Press because they were gone by the time, you know, I did my textbook, and I was bummed because they were great. But that's so smart. What you bring up is to, you know, sort of pitch at those conferences or just strike up the conversation and see what they say. I will say, too, that you'll get denied. I actually got accepted by a big publishing place for my textbook originally. And I went way down the rabbit hole with them. I did all the prospectus. It was like accepted. Yeah, I'd written the first chapter. It had gone out for review. The reviews had been actually pretty good. And at the 11th hour, they were like, oh, by the way, you need to change all this stuff. Right. And they wanted me to make my textbook exactly what I like rallied against, because my thing was like, look, I'm going to make my textbook small and cheap and fun. And they were like, oh, you have to add five chapters and you have to find a co-author from a four-year university, which made me so pissed. I was just like, and just go away. So I had a real bitter pill to swallow from that. But then, and I was like, just thought I was through with it. But then like 8 or 9 months later, I got in touch with a smaller publishing company and they were totally into what I was saying and they were great. It was Kendall Hunt. Who I ultimately went with, and those guys were, they got it, you know, like they got my idea, which I thought was so great. Well, the other place never really got it, you know, so it ultimately turned out really good for me.
Nice.
I'm curious. So, you know, we're just talking about how do you do this? If this is what, you know, how do you publish if you want to publish, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you think people should be thinking whether or not they should publish? Because, you know, there's a lot of people that want to say they've written a book and they've published a book and just for the ego part of it. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, what your thought is on at what point really should you publish? Should you really publish?
You do it. I mean, like I said, it's such a solo effort that like it has to be your baby. It's just like a dissertation or anything else. Like you have to think about it all the time. You have to do it anyways. Even when people tell you you shouldn't do it, you're still going to do it. Like you have to have that drive. If it's just some weird ego massage, like you're not going to have the drive, you know, like you have to have that. You have to be like, I need to publish this thing and the world needs to see it, you know, because you have to push yourself through those tough times.
But there's pretty big egos out there.
Yeah.
Well, that might actually get them through writing a book that they shouldn't write. I've read some books. I thought to myself, I don't know that they really should have been written. Yeah. That is really responsible.
Well, somebody published it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Andrew's right, though. You have to have a passion for it, right? It has to be something you really want to do. Unless this is like your 10th book and you're just like, what you do now is crank out books, right? Then it becomes like an obligation to find another topic to write a book about. I feel like Brian Fagan and Tom King are in that group, right? Like they're known as book authors. So like, what's my next book? But for people who's this their first book, it's like, you're going to go down this. You're not going to make a lot of money on it. And you're probably not going to make any money on it. Coming down to the ROI, you're probably going to lose a lot more money when you value your time than you're going to make. Unless you're writing a textbook that is, you know, really expensive and a lot of people buy it, then you might actually make some cash. But for most people, I think that first book is just not going to be, you're just not going to make anything except for credibility from it. And that's where the topic, the publisher and how you promote it and all that, you know, really comes into play. But yeah,
I think self-publishing is where I'm thinking, you know, people can go and publish whatever they want. And that's where you don't have that gatekeeper where, you know, people are like, you know, this is not a good idea.
I think there's a couple of things you need to look at. One is, so, I mean, obviously we're the CRM podcast, but there'll be a couple of people going down the academia route where their department, it has to be a book. Like that's what they have to do to be able to get tenure. And there are departments like that around the world. So that's basically what you end up with. But I think if people are also thinking about a book, you should really have a deep understanding of the mediums and understand, you know, a book is a specific type of medium. It has to be a book length topic. And, you know, not everything needs to be a book. So I think that's something else people need to consider is,
good point.
Do you just want a book because you want a book?
Right.
Or is it the right medium? And I think that's something people need to think about.
Because it could be expensive.
Yeah, but it's medium and also audience. You know what I mean? You also think like who actually cares? Who am I talking to? So yeah, I think Doug brings up a great point. And then based on your audience, you can go to the medium that will most serve the audience of what you're talking about.
I like Bill's idea that, you know, starting with a blog and really kind of testing it out and seeing whether or not, and exactly what Chris was saying is that, you know, over time you were writing these articles and you realized, you know what, there's enough here. So you have to be patient and not just want to jump into, I'm going to write a book, but start writing and figure out really, is there something here that other people haven't done that you have a unique perspective on and you, and that you actually have the credibility to write it. There are people that have written books that personally it's a little upsetting because, you know, there's a lot of people that think, oh, there's a book on this and they automatically have credibility because the person has the book. When that's not true. I mean, there's a lot of books out there that are that have a lot of crap in them and you can be steering people the wrong way.
But it's like turn that frown upside down kind of thing. You see those books and it should give you drive to be like, you know what? Mine's going to be better. This is great. Those are crap. You know, I love stuff like that.
I would also add that, you know, part of having a publisher is they can give you support and sometimes they also just wave it through, as we've sort of been talking about. So, you know, also like when you're beyond medium is also thinking about what you want to get out of having a book. So some people want a book, as we've been talking about, to like have their street cred or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, if your goal is to actually like maybe improve on the topic and you won't really care about street cred or, you know, academic credibility or whatever it is, I think you can do self-publishing. Also, you can hire editors. You can have friends look at it. I think there are good ways to have, you know, as someone else on this podcast who's done a lot of self-publishing, and we've actually, me, Chris, and Bill self-published Blogging Archaeology. I think you could do a really good job, probably even a better job than some publishers, if you're willing to put the work into it and willing to find people to actually like tell you that's crap. Cut this. You're a horrible writer. Yeah. Rewrite. You need that honest feedback. I think you can get that outside of a publisher. So, you know, I think people shouldn't look down on self-publishing if your goal is to get a topic out there or, you know, spread the knowledge.
Yeah. But you have to be honest. And it's just like you said, Doug, it's like if you're willing to put the work in. And for me personally, knowing myself, I'm like, there's no way I could ever self-publish anything, you know, so I go to the outside and I'm happy with my choice, but it is a choice.
Yeah. And I think I'll finish this segment out with some other topics regarding going with a publisher. If you self-publish, you're on your own timeline, right? So you got to look at, if you're going with a publisher, why are you going with a publisher? Are you going with a publisher because you've always wanted to publish a book with that publishing house. I mean, that is kind of a thing for some people, right? They're like, oh, I've always respected these guys. I want to have a book with my name on it and that publisher. That is definitely a reason people choose sometimes. But then also the push that your editor will give you, right? You might need that motivation, that push and that advice. And because they're not going to help you write the book necessarily. I mean, certain editors are a little more hands-on than others, but they will give you some pointers and they'll go over like a paragraph. This was my experience. They would like go over a paragraph or a page and say like, okay, now do that throughout the book because, you know, you did this everywhere. I was like, oh, son of a bitch. Okay. But they don't necessarily edit for content either sometimes. Again, different editors have different styles. But right. So if you need that kind of structure, that's another good reason to go with a publisher. But then also, I think one of the biggest reasons to choose the right publisher for your book is how are they going to promote it? Because one of the reasons you're only getting 8 or 9% is because they should be promoting your book. They should be promoting this and taking it to conferences and putting it in their newsletter and selling your book for you. That's one of the reasons why you go with a publisher is because they have that behind them. It's in their best interest to sell that book. And if they don't sell other books that are like the book you want to write, well, what are the chances that it's going to do very well? You know, my book never would have been published by Taylor and Francis or Routledge, which is under Taylor and Francis, because it's just not the kind of book that they do. But since they bought Left Coast Press's catalog, now my book says Routledge on the outside of the spine when you buy it. And did they promote that book in the last 5 years or 4 years since they bought Left Coast Press? No, not even a little bit. It's never at conferences. It's never anywhere, but it's on their website. You can find it. You can buy it there. They've raised the price several times, which is stupid. It's just that I would never publish this book with them. This is not the right kind of book to publish with that kind of publishing house. So with that, you know, you're better off spending your money on an ArcPodNet membership. So go to arcpodnet.com/members.
Oh, that was smooth, Chris. That was smooth.
Right? So we'll be back in a minute to wrap up this discussion. Welcome back to episode 241 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Doug, I think you had a comment right before I ended the segment.
Yeah, it's not going to be as a smooth segue as you're selling there, but... I was going to say something you guys had also mentioned, just triggered something, is if you're writing a book, I mean, we've sort of been talking about it as an individual, but, you know, a lot of times, a lot of people sort of team up and it'll be you and someone else writing a book or you and a couple of other people. And also, this comes back to sort of like your editor as well, is the process of doing a book can take years. The quickest, I think you might be able to get away counting it out in months if you already have an idea and you're super motivated and you can get everything done. But you're talking about a several year process. And with that, you want to think about like relationships, in that sometimes like when you're going to a publisher, it's not so much the publisher, but the editor, because you're going to be working with this person for a very long time, and they are going to be commenting on something that's going to be very dear to your heart. Maybe not, you know. And I think, yeah, a lot of something else people need to consider is the relationship. So either relationship between you and your other authors. Can you stand working with these people closely for the next couple of years? Also, you know, relationship with your editor. Do you like your editor? Can they give you honest feedback? Will you take honest feedback from them? And those are some things people need to consider.
Yeah. Real quick on that. My book was essentially written, like I mentioned, when I showed it to my eventual publisher, Left Coast Press. And it was 13 months after that it was a hardcover book. Like 13 months. And that's just because of the proposal process. They had to accept the contract. And then, you know, I had an editor and then I had a copy editor and they had to do the cover and the book and just getting it into the factory to actually get it made. You know, all that has to go on a cycle. So 13 months and I walked in with 60,000 words written, right? So that's a long time.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And also, you know, I'm working on a book. I don't know how many words or so, but I think I started it in 2018. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also was largely written too. So I had to fix a lot of stuff, but it was pretty much done and it's still taking 4 years. Yeah. But the other thing, I think Doug brought up something important too about the relationships. The other thing you might want to think about is the relationship to your own self, because your emotions are going to get in there a lot, right? So I think that just writing in general, if you're the kind of person that writes but doesn't want anyone else to see it, then you have to start with yourself first, because the thing that's holding you back is your own mind. If you're also the other kind of person that's pretty much like me that writes and then doesn't want to listen to other people's comments and all that other stuff, but you have to just swallow it when it comes to editors' comments, that's another a growth thing too, because nobody likes being told that this isn't good or this isn't actually what we want and just delete this entire chapter. But a lot of times that's what you got to hear, because what you're writing is not good and it doesn't make any sense, and who knows why you even tried to put it in there, right? So if you don't have other people read your stuff and give you good comments, not just technical comments, you know, of course on structure and all that other stuff, but you know, just comments on logic and why is this there? Like, you really need other people to help you make this finished project. And if you're the kind of person that can't deal with edits and comments and stuff like that, then you, once again, you have to start with your own self. And then finally, this is something that you're going to be working on for a long time, and you're going to be really, really, really connected to this thing. And at a certain point, you just seriously have to let it go, because there's only really two kinds of books that are out there. The ones that are just ideas in people's minds, and the other ones that are finished and published.
Right.
And, you know, if you ever wanted to get published, you just have to let it go and let those editorial comments and those other decisions that people are making on your work, like, you just have to let it flow through. Because if you hold tight on every single comma and every single change of word and, you know, cut and, you know, paragraph deletion, it's never going to get done.
So true. So true.
Good point.
Yeah, and it just, it feels so good though on that day when you let go, you know, you're like, here you go, world, whatever. Close enough.
It's like the, it's what I imagine in Stranger Things, what they feel when they use the force, you know, whatever, to just get rid of all your enemies, like, ah, and they all just fly away. Like, okay, you're just going to let it go.
Yeah. Totally true.
I think that's true of like all writing, basically. I mean, I'm not a particularly good writer, but I can do fairly decent editing. And one of the hardest things with editing is you can write like a sentence you really love or a paragraph you really love, but it actually won't fit into what you're writing about. And you have to learn to be like, cut and paste that into another, you know, your Word doc of like great ideas that just never happen sort of thing. Cause it's true. Like with a book, you'll have that chapter that you really want to have in there, but it completely messes up the entire flow of the book. And so you have to be able to accept that you can just cut out things, that it's great, but it's not great for what your particular thing is at that moment. And that is really tough.
I think Doug brings a really good point up, saying that he's saying, and I don't know if he's being humble, I'm sure, but that he's not a very good writer, but he's a good editor. And we have somebody on my staff that she's like, I can't do this because I'm not a good writer. I've never been a good writer. She just had this block in her head that I'm not a good writer. She is absolutely our best editor. Absolutely. And I think she's a good writer, but she still has that in her head. That's not where she's at, but she's our best editor. And so when you're looking for somebody to, you know, go over your transcript or whatever it is that you're reading, you're looking for somebody. You're not necessarily looking for the best writer. You're looking for somebody who's really a good editor. I think to have both is important, but don't just like, you know, say, okay, I have to have somebody who's written a book before. I have to have somebody who's an amazing writer before. Sometimes, you know, the people that are not the best writers are actually really good editors.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think in the last half of this segment, we should really bring up what most likely first-time authors are always wondering is, can you make any money doing this, right? Can you actually make any money, you know, thinking of maybe authoring or publishing as a career almost, right? And like we said before, if you're a Tom King or a Brian Fagan, you probably can, right? It's still not like Harry Potter numbers, but you know, it's good numbers more than likely. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to keep cranking out books like this, because it's a long time, as we've talked about for the last almost hour. It's a long cycle in getting this done, and especially if you're going to put something together that's, you know, well researched and well written and edited. I mean, it's a year to a couple of years, and or more. And if you're going to do this as a career, well, you have to be able to support yourself doing that. So I will cut to the chase right now. I'm still getting checks from Taylor and Francis. I get one every June. My last one was, I'd had to pull up my account right here, June 24th, which means payday is coming soon. As we're recording this, it's June 5th. So I'm expecting anything from Taylor and Francis coming soon. And last year, which would have been I think the sixth or seventh year my book was out. I think last year was, because I think it was published in 2014. So that would have been the seventh year. We're coming up on the eighth year. But last year my deposit was, wait for it, $43.78.
Oh, all right, money bags. Ooh,
big time, big time.
So yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. To be honest, though, with like zero promotion from either myself or Taylor and Francis, I'm kind of shocked that I got that much. Because like I said, I get 8% if they buy the book from the publisher, right? 8% of, I think Taylor and Francis is selling it for like 40 some odd dollars right now, which is, again, ridiculous. It's a $20 book at best. But I think they're selling it for 40 something, and I get 8% off of that. Now, if you buy it from Amazon, which is more than likely where people are getting it, yeah, I get like 5% or 4% or something like that. It's way less if you buy it from another reseller. And if you buy the ebook, I think there's an ebook, and I don't think there's an audiobook. I don't think they did one of those, but I think there's an ebook, and I get even less off the ebook. So
right,
I'm shocked that it's that much. When you're looking at 8%, I mean, that's like, I don't know, 50 to 100 sales, you know, or something like that, or whatever it is in the year before that. And it's calendar year. So they stop the billing at the end of the calendar year, and then right, they wait until June to pay you because they figure all that stuff out. So,
yep.
But yeah, that's where I'm at with that book. And it's been about that almost every year since I published it.
That's my experience too, pretty much. But I'm brand new to the, like, my book was just published in January 2022. So so far I've gotten is nothing because the check hasn't, you know, come around yet. But my sweet deal is better than your sad 8%, my friend.
Oh yeah,
I think I'm 12 or something like that. And
man,
I know, dude. I'm famous. But that brings up, that is one of the main things people ask. You know, like, how much do you make? And I would not go into it thinking you're gonna like have a new career, because you're not Brian Fagan and you're not Tom King. But I would just think of it as a side hustle. You know, think of it as something like when that check comes in, you go, oh, sweet. You know, oh, that's cool. I'll go out to dinner because I wrote this book. Like, you know, that's what it is. That's that world. So, yeah, don't think you're going to get rich. It's just a fun side hustle, but it's something you're passionate about and it's worth it. You know,
well, a couple of things on that, though, because I think I beat those records since Amazon pays every month. So when you self-publish on Kindle Direct, like I have, and I have three eBooks on there, and they, I think the most expensive one is like $7.99, right? So every other one is $4.99. Every month I get anywhere from $10 to $40 from those three eBooks. And I have for like the last, I don't know, 7 years since I published them or whatever. Yeah. So that's what happens when you, and I hired editors to edit those books too. I think the first one I did it myself. And then after that, I had a couple other CRMers do like internal reviews on them. And then I had an editor actually go through it. And, you know, so that's if you self-publish, then you get the money, right? And you put it on there, you're responsible for all the content, but you get all the money. And it just keeps flowing in a small stream. Once again, not enough to retire on. But the thing that my wife, oh, go ahead.
What's Amazon's cut? Is it 70-30?
I don't remember. No, I think they're less. Oh yeah. Yeah. The publisher gets 70 and Amazon gets 30, right? I can't remember. I'll have to look at it.
When you self-publish, I was wondering what your cut is when you self-publish, because Amazon definitely takes something for you to publish on Amazon, but I just couldn't remember what the percentage was.
So I know that there's a fee based on how many kilobytes, but it's like pennies per sale, right? Like less than a penny even per sale, because my books aren't huge.
And then they also, it depends how much you charge for it as well. They take a percentage if it's over like $7.99. There's a bunch of different, it's a bit complicated.
Yeah.
Is it?
But they're like
The more you try to charge, the more they take, right, Doug? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how about the other side? We're talking about how much money you make. How much money does it cost if you're actually, let's say, self-publishing a book, an actual book, like a tangible book, not an ebook?
Yeah, I don't know, because I publish online, right? So
right.
In a sense, there's no difference, because if you do, say, print on demand, because you're not going to be, so if you self-publish, you're not going to be able to like do a 100 or 200 book print run. I mean, you could, and then spend the rest of your life hawking them at conferences.
Right.
But you're never going to get them into like bookstores or to universities. Right. But you could do basically print on demand. And essentially that, so Amazon does that as well. And there's a couple of other places.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of deal. You basically, they'll charge you, you know, X, it'll be so much per, well, it depends okay, sorry, this is going to get a bit complicated, but, you know, quality of paper, so your paperweight, is it hardback, paperback, are you using glossy covers? Yeah, right. Picture, yeah. Color pictures, glossy, yeah. Cover, you know, it depends on your cover, glossy, right. Matted, there's a whole bunch of stuff, but essentially you get that charge, and it could be basically a fixed price, and you could pad on top of that whatever you want. So let's say, you know, it costs $12 plus shipping, whatever that is, what it is to publish it. You could then charge like 20 plus shipping or 25. So it's up to you to do that. So it doesn't, you can basically pass on the unit cost directly to whoever wants that.
Right.
If you're self-publishing.
Well, so the other piece too, Doug, because I remember doing this through CreateSpace and they got bought by Amazon. You do, Doug's exactly right. You choose the paper and you choose whether it's going to be paperback and what the size and dimensions of it are going to be too. So that matters. Like the bigger book with more glossy images is going to cost more to create. However, person who buys it, they get a discount based on how many they get. So if they just get one, then they pay, you know, like whatever you set, $24.99. But if they buy 20 of them, then it could be down to like $21. And then if they buy 100 of them, you know, it could be down to $17. When it only costs Amazon like $13 or $14 to produce each book. So once again, you set the price, but you also set the break on the deal. Mm-hmm. And you want to have an incentive for them to buy more of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is just kind of a little side conversation here, separate from what we've been talking about, which is just actually writing books. But I did want to talk a little bit about journals, which is the first thing that, you know, those of us that are, you know, start off in academia, that's the first experience that we have in publishing our actual written work. And I'm curious what everybody thinks about where, you know, the future of journals is. That's the reason I ask. There was a recent email that went out to members and for the California Archaeology Journal, and they literally had no submissions. Like Kathleen Hall was begging for people to submit and still is. And, you know, I think that it is we're seeing kind of a paradigm shift in that used to be competitive, used to be difficult to get in certain journals to get yourself published. And now we have, like, just within a few years, we have journals that are begging for submissions.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what everybody's opinion is on why that is the case.
I have my own ideas, but I super want to hear what Doug has to say.
Yeah. So I've done the research on this. And the reason you're having that happen is, so like the number of journals is skyrocketing. Like I'll try to put it in the show notes. I did a paper maybe 5 years ago for EAA or no, the German one. One of those, it was one of the open access German journals, DF, whatever. I'll send the link. But basically, like, it looks like exponential growth. Like, you see, I've tracked, you basically have, not a lot of journals, and then it hits about the 1980s, 1990s. And essentially, we now have, last count I had, and this is not just English language, is like 700 journals. And that's probably not anything. We're probably pushing 1,000 archaeology journals. And the reason behind that is consolidation. So a lot of the publishers are now being bought out and they're sort of turning into monopolies. But what's driving that is universities and the big bundles. So what happens is the publishers will bundle together all their journals. So they say, look, for a low fee of what, you know, 10 million, you can get 2,000 journals. And everyone looks at the numbers and like, okay, 2,000 journals, that's better than like 500 journals for the same price, not caring about quality. So what we've seen is just tons of organizations just start creating journals left and right. Because, you know, it costs them almost no money to create a digital journal. Even a print one costs no money for those big publishers. And almost all universities now do bundled big deals with a publisher. So they're not just buying one journal, they're buying 500 journals. And so it's all about the number. Manny was a big one before it got bought out and started just creating journals left and right. They also bought a lot of people. They bought Left Coast Press journals. They bought the other smaller one, Adamira, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one they bought. And then Cambridge is now becoming a big one where they were adding more journals. Like, it's basically become somewhat of an arms race to just produce as many journals because it has to do with the big bundles for universities, and that's where the money's at.
But see, on the flip side, on the flip side, what I noticed though is if you're going for tenure, it's always the same two or three journals that they want to see you in. So that's why I think it's so interesting, this sort of dichotomy.
Yeah. There's also another paper that went out. This was published maybe 15 years ago by AAA, American Anthropology. And it really depends on the university. So some universities literally have, you need to be published in these three journals. Anything else, you didn't publish. They just look at it as like you wasted your time and you did, you know, why were you wasting your time publishing anywhere else? But that's really mixed. It really depends. And then there's a lot of other places that are just like, yeah, you know, whatever, just send in your tenure application. Yeah, put a bunch of journals in there. Here's a box, fill it up, and we'll see you at tenure review. So it's really mixed.
Yeah.
And yeah, so basically we're being driven by a ton of journals because of the economics of, it's not even has to do with archaeology. It's just the economics of publishing and universities buying big bundles of journals. And that might change once everything flips open access. But at that point, it still does it. They still have no incentive to have fewer journals because, you know, it costs them no money. Open access, even if they only publish one or two articles a year, it's free money coming in. Yeah. I exaggerate with the free money. I know there's some minor costs and stuff, but yeah, you have so many places you could publish or shop around. So now even if a paper doesn't get published in your first venue, you have, I don't know, in English language, I forget what, maybe 300 or 400 different archaeology journals. I'm talking like pretty much pure archaeology. If you break out into like museums and general heritage, add a couple hundred extra on top of that. I'm sorry, guys, we're probably going over time now.
It's all right. But the other critical factor too, Doug, is that there's just fewer professors who can ever write anything. And it's pretty much professors that are writing these articles. So, you know, you got fewer professors that are on the tenure track and more adjuncts. That means people who are overworked and, you know, they're not going to get their job. It's almost impossible for them to publish or get hired after a few years. So that's another huge thing. There's just fewer people who are writing for this stuff at a time when there's more journals.
Okay, well, on that happy note, I think we're going to end this podcast, at least the regular part of the podcast. However, as you can see, we do have a lot more to talk about. Journal publishing, which is more than likely the route that anybody who wants to publish and become an author is going to go, is more than likely the journal route, just because, as we've stated, book publishing is still kind of like, still a little special in the fact that there's more gatekeepers in book publishing unless you self-publish. So we're going to do that in the bonus segment. So if you're a member, head over to your member pages and find this episode. You'll find the ad-free version with, again, no ads, and you'll find it typically a few days early, but you're already listening to it, so it's already out. And the bonus segment will be listed right there with the episode in the bonus pages, not in the regular pages, because this is a benefit. If you're not a member, head over to arcpodnet.com/members. It's only $7.99 a month. I think I said per day one time, which would be, you know, we'd all be driving Bentleys if that were the case, but it's not. It's $7.99 a month, and it's, I think, 20% discount if you get it annually. So it's actually pretty affordable, helps us keep the lights on, and you get a lot of value for that. So here we go. We're going to do the bonus segment next. Again, head over to those pages. And if you're not a member, arcpodnet.com/members. We'll see you guys next time.
Goodbye.
All right.
You weren't prepared for it, Chris. You weren't prepared for it.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye, Doug.
Goodbye.
See you guys next time.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
You guys all just waiting. And Doug, I'm just gonna bring it back in. He's even muted. All right, we're gonna edit. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.